July 16th, 2013, 12:22 p.m. Alright, so this will be the beginning of my chronicling my adventures using RPG Maker. I've actually surprisingly never used any version of the program before, so this is totally new to me. I've just installed it, and I'm going to just sort of start messing around right now. I don't have any solid ideas from what my game's going to be yet, but I'll keep you guys updated as that happens. I'm going to be doing some brainstorming soon.
That's Nick Mulligan, also known as Faison Chaos. He bought a copy of RPG Maker, hoping to see how far he'd get on a project before I started getting this podcast together.
August 19th, 2013, 11:32 p.m. It's obviously been a while since I've recorded anything, and that's because I honestly haven't made a ton of progress. I spent about 4 hours total on what I'm now calling Project Toad, following up Double Fine's example of naming projects after local eateries of sorts. This was after a local pub called The Toad. Over those 4 hours, I've completely finished planning out everything for the game, so I'm about to start working on the game proper. I spent a while first just sort of planning out what I was going to do, and then after that I spent a lot of time actually doing some research into Celtic and Irish mythology, because a lot of the names for characters and locales are based off of Celtic and Irish mythology, and I've sort of spent a lot of time finding names that fit what I was doing with the story, while still making sense with their mythological counterparts. I spent about 4 hours, that's all the planning. I'm hoping to make approximately a 2 to 3 hour experience, but I'll see what I end up managing to do.
It didn't take long for him to realize what everyone realizes when they decide to give RPG Maker a try. That making an RPG, even when using a convenient tool like RPG Maker, is hard.
August 22nd, 12:01 a.m. I have now worked on the project for about 11 hours total, and I think this is everything I'm going to be able to get done. I've just finished making the prologue, so obviously taking a lot more time than I realized it would, but it's been fun, and I do plan to continue working on the game because I would like to see it through to completion after all this work that I've put into it. So there you have it. That was my adventure in RPG Maker. I had a lot of fun. In the end, I think it kind of ended up turning out the approach that a lot of people take to school projects. You just kind of work on it here and there, and then once you realize that you're getting close to the deadline, you just do a mad dash for the finish line. Just, my finish line was a lot further away than I thought it was. But I also think part of it was once I started working on the game proper, it sort of got rolling a bit more, so I think I'll be able to continue working on it more quickly from here on out, and I will let you guys know when I finish with it, with the voicemail or something.
Well, this is the Fangamer Podcast. I'm your host, Charlie, and this episode is all about small-time RPGs, whether made for fun or for profit. I think Nick's experience is a pretty common one. RPG Maker is such an enticing idea, especially if you grew up playing games like Dragon Warrior or Lufia. RPG Maker is a tool you can get fairly cheaply, which you can use to make your own RPGs, finally letting you use all of those story ideas and characters you've had floating around in your head. And then you boot up the program and realize just how much work you have ahead of you. It's not just about story when building an RPG. There's music, art, and mechanics to figure out, and that's just for a bare-bones experience. Crafting an emotionally satisfying scenario or a challenging boss battle is an art that people are still trying to understand, even among the pros. Many potential young game designers have cut their teeth on RPG Maker early on, and many walk away in defeat. I count myself among their numbers, having spent a few months working on a vague idea for a game I had a little over a decade ago. It's a daunting process, and I have an enormous amount of respect for anyone who sticks with RPG Maker and uses it to craft something wonderful. And it happens! Just look at Ken Gao's incredible game To the Moon, for example. I eventually found an outlet for my game design ideas using tabletop systems, but luckily many people aren't scared away by their first attempt at making a game. I've got two stories today from people who work hard to keep RPGs alive, despite not having a big budget or publisher to fund them. And they both have work you can play right now. First, we have a free game that's being built right now by an old friend of the podcast. Our second segment is from an interview I had with one of the members of the two-man team that is the indie RPG studio, Zeboid Games. But first, our old friend Rune Devros, a frequent podcast voicemailer, is finishing up his passion project RPG. Our buddy Kevin Chai spoke with him about it.
Hey, it's me, Kevin Chai, and here I am with Rune Devros, and we're going to talk about his game, Story of a Lost Sky.
Hi, I'm Rune Devros, lead developer of Story of a Lost Sky, and I'm very happy to be talking with Kevin today about my game.
Now, this is a Toho Doujin game.
Toho is a rather popular 2D vertical shooting series from Japan. It's notable because it's made by a single guy named Zune, and it's managed to spawn this gigantic fan following overseas where tens of thousands of people attend these massive conventions just to participate in this community development of the Toho world. These games are extremely difficult vertical shooting games, also known as Danmaku, but they've also spawned a whole fan community with music and other fan games and comics, and just about anything you could think of exists for Toho. So Story of a Lost Sky takes place in the Toho world, which is heavily steeped in Japanese myth and folklore. So this is a world where gods, demons, and magicians are very much a part of the daily life, and along with it, all the danger and adventure and mystery of such a world. Our project, Story of a Lost Sky, focuses on one specific character, Yomu, a ghost samurai from the Netherworld, and she gets wrapped up in this conflict between spirits that represent the guardians of the forest, who are trying to protect it against everyone else, and the rest of Gensokyo, who don't really agree with their methods. And throughout the game, she's joined by a rather diverse set of allies. The game itself is a turn-based strategy game. If you've played games like Fire Emblem or FF Tactics, the gameplay is in that genre. And this is a game where the player is asked to command a party of heroes on a grid-like map against a set of enemy forces. So, we started this project at the end of my third year in college, so that was 2008 in May. So I was sitting there in my apartment, really bored, and I had just joined the Toho community just before. And so that means that we've been working on this project for up to 5 years now. When I joined the community in 2006, it was at a time when Toho was just making its way across the ocean. We had some rather popular fan videos that brought Toho to the attention of the people in the West. So around that time, I soon discovered that there was this entire collection of fan-driven content being created in Japan. And having consumed a bit of this and just appreciating the sheer scale of what was being created, I guess I wanted to participate in whatever way I can. I'm a terrible artist, I can't do music, but I would say that I'm an okay programmer, so I wanted to try my hand at creating a game. At the time, I had also recently finished FF Tactics, so I was looking around, and in 2008, there wasn't really that many Toho strategy RPGs being made, either overseas or in the fledgling community of game developers here in the West, which are typically based off of the Shrine Maiden forums. So I started my own project. I put together a small prototype, uploaded it to Shrine Maiden, and that's where the project got rolling from there.
This is a tactical strategy RPG, This game, Story of a Lost Sky. To develop it, you are using Python.
I've come from a physics background, not a CS background, so my code foo isn't as up to task. So, in 2008, I looked around to see what options that I had. My background was in MATLAB, and I had dabbled a little bit in Python. So, I looked up and see how I could create games using Python, and there was a nice little library called Pygame, which is a simple game-making library. It handles all the graphics and audio and player input stuff for you. And I basically buckled down, picked up a tutorial book, and started working through it. In hindsight, though, if I were to make this game today, I would probably not choose Pygame, because we have run into a handful of its limitations.
Had you ever completed a game or something similar before?
Something similar before, not really, but I have been tinkering in game development all the way since, I guess, in middle school. My first project was about a guy who, you know, like a blue shirt and green pants, he had a really long stick and he flailed it around and bashed enemies with it. It was done in a Game Maker, like, version 1 all the way back, and I remember sitting there for, like, 3 hours waiting for this 30 megabyte game-making program to download off my AOL dial-up. After that, I also experimented with some RPG Maker games. I happened to write a story and then crafted an RPG Maker game around it. And finally, the current group that I'm with, Feathered Melody Productions, we actually sprang up front as a visual novel development group. So in the years preceding when we started Story of a Lost Sky, we had been tinkering with making some visual novels. We completed one, and then kind of, sort of, completed another, but I don't think we ever released the final version of the second one.
For this project, Story of the Lost Sky, did you think that you could handle it all on your own, or did you already have people that you know were going to work on it with you?
So, I knew from the get-go that there was no possible way I was going to do this on my own. Just the scale of the project is, and my lack of artistic skill, was going to necessitate bringing other people into this project. What I started doing was, I've seen this recurring pattern a lot in the just in people who are starting off with their projects, and they tend to just put an idea out, just a grand plan, usually some kind of an outline of their story. But what we did to start to get this project rolling was I sat down and I coded together a very simple prototype of our game. It was ridiculously simple, and looking back, it's impressive how far that we've come from that time. We had like 6 characters on a plain green background and rudimentary controls, and I showed that it was enough of a proof of concept for what kind of strategy RPG I was going. So that thread went up on Shrine Maiden back in 2008, and the response I got was pretty positive. There were a handful of people that immediately jumped in and started helping out, either from volunteering to help with the sprites or just offering general design guidance. I'd say it was a very collaborative effort with the community.
Since the beginning, has the scale of the game changed? How big of a game did you think you were going to make in comparison to how it's turned out?
If the challenge level of our original plan was something like Mount Everest, I'd say that we maybe, that the current scale is, I don't know, what's a really tall mountain in the U.S.?
Mount McKinley?
I guess we scaled it down to something like that. So, one of our biggest bottlenecks has just been just the amount of art resources for the project of the scale that we were imagining back then. We had an entire chapter that we ended up having to cut, simply because it was going to be an indoor level, and creating that map would have been horrendously difficult.
How close is this game to being released in a full version 1.0 form?
So, I guess we take a little bit of a different track than many game developers, although it has been catching on lately. So what our release system is that we incrementally release it, and whenever we finish a major revision, we put it out to our website and send it out to the world to play and get feedback on. So we're constantly doing this cycle of develop, release, get feedback, and then go back and develop and add some more stuff to it. But as far as how much progress we've made, so the engine itself is pretty stable at the moment. It took a long time to get here. So all the back end, all the number crunching in the game and how all the maps work, we haven't really had to touch that in a long time. As far as progression through the game is concerned, we've completed 3 of 5 chapters. We originally had 6, but we pared it down to 5, and we expect to be able to tack on a handful of side quests. For a 1.0 version, we're shooting to finish the main story chapters by the end of this year. I think that's a bit of a tall order for us, but I think we can do it. And then it'll continue developing and being polished after that. I do like to encourage others to release early and release often. I think it's good to have that continuous feedback, especially if this is just a tiny hobbies project that we're not actually planning on selling. The game is actually available for free online, and it's licensed under an open source license. The game has undergone quite a few mechanics revisions. We've spent a lot of time playing around with mechanics that didn't work so well. And this is a common feature of making games where you come up with a mechanic and it sounds great on paper. And then when you get into the game, you notice that maybe it's not really an optimal way of using it. There may be another more simple skill that you use, that the player uses, instead of opting to use that very meticulously laid out strategy for reasons that may be as simple as players tend to favor efficiencies. A lot of the ideas that we brainstormed way back in 2008, they really never left the drawing board. There are a couple of reasons there. One is that our game ended up much smaller than we had envisioned. So some of the things like elaborate crafting systems or the ability for characters to get better with spells over time, they make sense if we were developing, say, a game on the scale of like Fire Emblem Awakening for the 3DS or the original FF Tactics, where the playtime is on the order of 40 or 50 or 100 hours. I think I may have sunk that much into Fire Emblem Awakening. But for a game that's closer, I think, to, say, 20 hours max, a lot of these mechanics don't really make sense. So if we had the resources and the time to make a much larger scale game, I think that would be the way that we go. But I think for just a doujin or a fan-made game for the Toho series, simple mechanics work best.
So this is a doujin game, and you're going to be releasing it for free.
Mm-hmm.
How does that play into the development? Like, are you motivated to do different things that you wouldn't have been to do if you were trying to make a game to sell to people for money?
So typically, doujin works in Japan are independently created works. They may or may not be fan works, but in Japan, it's completely common for fan works to be sold at, say, conventions. For instance, the Comiket convention, I believe, had somewhere on the order of 600,000 attendees this year. So the scale is quite large. Ultimately, though, I don't want to deal with the monetary aspects of putting a game together, so I ended up releasing this game for free. And really, to me, the project that we're working on is really our contribution to, I guess, just this ongoing conversation of what is the Toho world. Zoom sets out a world of his, and alongside Zoom, others in the fan community, we contribute different viewpoints into what happens in his world. I think Shell, in the book The Art of Game Design, refers to these as transmedia worlds. And Toho is unique in that I think it kind of sprung up accidentally. I don't think Zune was intending for this to be such a massive phenomenon, but what happened was we have a way of lots of people just creating their own visions of the world that Toho takes place in. And as a result, we have something for everyone. We have things for people who like comics, things for people who like every possible genre of music. So I guess our contribution is, if you like Toho and strategy RPGs, we want to make the game for those people.
How has developing a game of your own changed the way that you think about playing games?
So when I started making this game, I had dabbled in a bit of game development before, as I mentioned, but I had never really written my own, like, game engine from scratch, as on the mechanics side, of course. So, to me, video games before this point were kind of a black box. There was this magical black box that contained a world, and somehow that world got onto the TV screen, and with the controller in hand, you interacted with it. So I guess having actually gone and made the contents of that black box, what happened was that I started seeing games, I guess, in a more systems-like approach, that I can more easily see and unravel how their mechanics work, and I suppose a bit of that magic has been lost, but at the same time, I also have a deeper appreciation for what goes into making a game, and what are some of the challenges that creators face when putting together a project.
When this game is completely done and you're satisfied with the entirety of it, will you then
that
go
may be
on?
A couple decades.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
Well, after that, will you make another game?
So, game development is probably the most rewarding hobby that I've taken a part in. So, I definitely want to continue making games. I'm not sure if I want to stay in the Toho world, though. I have, like, this little notebook, and it's full of just ideas that I scribble down. And I had an idea for a game that I want to make after this, which is two characters on a tile grid, and you have things like environmental interactions, and it's just manipulating two characters and having them cooperate. So I guess that's my idea for the next project, but I doubt that I'll get started on that anytime soon. I mainly want to focus on getting this game complete. Dream. When I was young, a dream of sweet illusion, and a glimpse of hope and unity, and a vision of one sweet union. But a cold wind blows, and a dark rain falls, and in my heart it shows, look what they've done to my dream.
You can download Story of a Lost Sky's current chapters right now at lostsky.featheredmelody.com. Rune is planning to have the remaining chapters complete by the end of the year. Finishing a game with a small studio is an impressive feat in and of itself. Bill Sternberg of Z-Boy Games has finished 4.
I guess the first thing that a lot of people don't may or may not realize is Z-Boy is just the two of us. It's me and Robert. Our first game was released in 2010 as a team, which is Breath of Death 7, and I believe that was in, I don't know, early 2010. I want to say March, but it's been a while. Back in the, the 90s, I used to do mods for Doom and Duke Nukem 3D, and then a few here and there for Quake and Unreal Tournament. I released one or two on the internet or whatever, and that was fun. It was all just a hobby. My thinking was always that, you know, if you want to be in the video game industry, this was growing up in the 90s, you know, 80s, 90s, early 2000s, is that you choose that career early on, and you focus on it, and then, you know, you have to start making stuff and applying for those jobs, blah, blah, blah. Well, right around the time I was, you know, kind of picking my career, there was kind of this, the dot-bomb, the crash after the dot-com, and the industry was flooded with software engineers and coders and stuff. So that's why I decided to go to law school. But I've always had that passion. I've always wanted to program and make games. I taught myself stuff like QBasic in middle school, and continued learning how to do mods and write code in C++ in high school. And then in college, I made a bunch of silly mods and little fan games that I did or didn't release. And into law school, I did that Atari game. It's always been this passion. And And I've always followed the industry very closely just because I'm interested in it. All the news, developers, what's happening to them, what games are selling, which ones are flopping, what studios are succeeding, which ones are folding. And that's something Robert's been interested in too. And we kind of knew each other from the various, well, from the Penny Arcade forums where we tracked industry news and stuff. And that kind of, that passion for the industry and how these businesses work and stuff was another reason we work well together as a team, because we agree on a lot of stuff about how to run the company. So I guess you could say I've only been in the industry as far as selling commercial games since Breath of Death 7, but I feel like I've been, that the industry has been a huge part of my life for, you know, decades. When we started working together to make RPGs, it was mostly just a fun project to do. I was still in law school full-time, and Robert was working as a teacher, so it's not like we dropped everything and said, okay, we're going to make an indie studio, and that's what we're going to do full-time forever and ever. We wanted that to be the end goal, but at the time, it was kind of like, oh, let's see how we can do this first. So with Breath of Death 7, we just wanted to make a modest and small scope style of game, because it was the first game we'd worked together on, and we didn't want our ambitions to run wild. And because of that, we wanted to basically contain everything that is fun about an RPG of the Dragon Quest style, and I say that generally, but to do it and condense it into a 4-hour game so that when you play it, you're getting all this fun stuff out of RPGs, but it's new stuff's constantly happening and constantly coming at you. We just wanted to do it, you know, in a humble fashion and do it as our first project and keep the scope small and the story, you know, basic and silly, and just kind of make it as unique as possible so it stood out from the other indie RPGs at the time. So it was kind of like a silly, let's see how this goes and let's make it fun, let's condense it and see how people like this fast, you know, faster paced, more streamlined RPG. When we started this, we were only on Xbox Live Indie Games, and that market really only, well, it for the most part, it supports $1 games, with the exception of a few $3 games, and that market is also very small. For a lot, you know, there's a lot of reasons you might argue why. But at the time, just having Xbox Live Indie Games as our platform was not enough. We did really well on that platform compared to many developers. I can't complain about that. But we couldn't support a two-man studio just on revenue from that alone. When we finally got a contract for Steam for Cthulhu Saves the World plus Breath of Death, it was a really tough decision, actually, to decide, you know, do we make this $3 like on Xbox Live Indie Games? Or do we, you know, do we make it $5 but add a bunch of content to try and justify the $2 hike or what? Well, I guess just our experience in Xbox Indie Games made us feel like we needed to be sure our price was low enough that it was attractive, you know, despite the humbleness of the types of game and the limited size of the RPG market. And that's why we decided on $3. But the day we launched on Steam was a huge pivotal turning point for our company, because after a week of sales on Steam, we knew that we could basically do that full time from then forward. It was huge. We couldn't believe how well it was doing, and it was a very humbling experience seeing how many people were talking about it, how many people were buying it and playing it and enjoying it. And it was just, you know, our first two games, and it was $3. So yeah, it was definitely enough to sustain us. And the next two games we released, the Penny Arcade games, also did about as well. Our best selling one, obviously, still Cthulhu Saves the World. But Rainslick 3 and 4, you know, we had Penny Arcade helping us out with, you know, promotional efforts. And of course, you know, they took a percentage of the revenue, obviously. So, yeah, just selling the games for $5 works really well for a small team, as long as you're on a platform like Steam, or maybe if you can succeed on iOS, or maybe if you can succeed on goodoldgames.com or GOG.com. Just that low price point works because we keep our costs down. There's only two of us, and most of the money basically pays for us to work another day. So when we release a game and it does really well, we're like, yay, we can work for another year and make our next game or whatever, like that kind of thing. So yeah, for a two-man team with a small budget, minimal cost, and trying to to release her games on one or two platforms like Xbox and Steam, it works pretty well at the sub $10 level. Both Robert and I both have families. The platform takes its cut, and then you subtract expensive, and whatever's left is basically divided 50-50 between me and Robert, and that money is to support our families. It's our living expenses so we can keep working on and making games. So it's not just me, cheap apartment, and not going anywhere or doing anything. It's also, I have a wife, and we are actually expecting a baby soon, later this year, so yay! And Robert's got four children and a wife, too, so yeah, it's supporting our families as well.
What's interesting to me about ZBoid isn't just that they make classic-looking RPGs today. They make them small, they make them streamlined, they introduce interesting new RPG mechanics so that, while the games look and feel familiar, they play in such a way that feels like there's always something interesting to do, even from battle to battle.
It's an interesting topic because a lot of people outside of the RPG scene, or a lot of people that don't really pay attention to the RPG, especially JRPG market, they think that the mechanics haven't changed. They think, oh boy, here's another JRPG. It's going to be boring, turn-based, and slow, and it's going to be exactly like Final Fantasy IV that I played ages ago. You know, that there seems to be that, that reputation or whatever for JRPGs, but they're not. I mean, there's so many different ones. You know, certain ones stick to their formulas because they're still tried and true, like Dragon Quest. Some of the more recent releases, but even Dragon Quest has kind of changed it up with Dragon Quest 9 and 10. And I guess you could say that the newer games are trying to incorporate more streamlined stuff. They're trying to incorporate more story and trying to keep things more varied, but it just depends on what series you're looking at and which game in which series. So I guess a lot of older games, you know, I want to say that they created these conventions and so they stuck to them, and then later on those conventions evolved and then we got newer tech that allowed us to do newer things. But yeah, it really depends on what game and what series. I like to say that Chrono Trigger is a super awesome example of 16-bit RPGs because despite its limitations, the gameplay is smooth and the story and events of the game are fast-paced. I feel like almost today, a lot of RPGs purposefully drag out the combat and it drags out the story, and it tries to create a game that's 100 plus hours long because the developers feel like that's the expectation now. You go back and play Chrono Trigger, it's a blast because things are constantly happening. It's so streamlined. You can play the whole game in like 15 hours or less. I think that's something that newer RPGs should focus on, is streamlined gameplay and entertaining the player instead of trying to fluff it up with, you know, too many battles or a story that's dragged out over 100 hours or something. I can definitely say one of the inspirations for both of us that we can totally agree on is Chrono Trigger. And that's because you always feel like you're going, that what you're doing matters. You're always moving forward. The story's always evolving. There's always something interesting happening next. And the battle system, battle mechanics, there's constantly opening up new opportunities and ways to make the battles interesting. So you're always either gaining a new character, or you're losing a character, or you're gaining a new tech for one guy or the other character, or they're gaining a new unite technique that'll work with, you know, one or more characters together. And there's new enemies, and there's an elemental aspect to it. That's a whole lot of depth in terms of the gameplay. It's very approachable and easy to learn. But, you know, like I said earlier, it's very streamlined. There's always new and interesting stuff happening throughout the game in every aspect. So that's definitely something that's inspired us. I did want to say that a lot of RPG gamers love random battles. Not all of them, but there's definitely two faces to that coin or whatever. A lot of RPG gamers hate random battles because they feel like the game is periodically arbitrarily stopping them in their tracks from their progress. I mean, I can see why they feel that way. You know, it's, oh, the developer didn't set this battle here. This is just, they created a bunch of battles, now they're throwing them at us at random, and it's frustrating. But on the other hand, there's a lot of RPG gamers that freaking love random battles because there's constantly a challenge, and you never know exactly when or what's going to hit you. And so it's kind of always keeps you on your feet. And there's a certain number of RPG gamers that love grinding too. I know everybody says, oh, does this game have grinding? Oh god, I don't want to play this, it has too much grinding. Well, there's actually a lot of RPG gamers and players out there that love grinding, and that's one of the reasons with Breath of Death 7 and Cthulhu Saves the World, there's a limit to the random encounters, but even after that limit is passed, you can still choose to fight battles afterwards, because a certain number of gamers really just like to keep battling and create, you know, overpowered characters early on so they can steamroll the enemies, you know, through a certain point in the game. So, you know, that was definitely one of the reasons we put that into our first two games, for sure.
I've been so impressed by their small-scale work that I've been thinking about what would happen if Zeboid made a larger-scale game. As it turns out, they're working on one. It's called Cosmic Star Heroine.
It's our big new IP. You know, I guess all of our last games are IPs, so it's we're really excited about it for a bunch of reasons. For one, it's our first fully sci-fi game. You know, it's not set in a fantasy setting, you know, with swords and magic, or in the traditional fantasy sense. Not a lot of JRPGs, especially indie ones, are set in the, you know, the distant sci-fi future. So we feel like it's a cool way to do something in a new and interesting setting that a lot of old school and newer indie RPGs don't really do. We have a really cool main character and plot that I'm in love with. There's a secret spy agent element to it too, and I think that's really, really cool topic and a really cool way to present an RPG, because usually it's, you know, it's the epic story about some, you know, young lad who takes up the sword and defeats the dragons. But this has this whole spy element to it, and there's espionage and stuff like that. So there's going to be a little bit of that going on, a little bit of secret and stealth-related stuff, which I think is really exciting because I love those elements in games. And then another cool thing we're doing is we're finally doing the Chrono Trigger-style gameplay. And again, not a lot of indie RPGs do this. A lot of them stick to the Final Fantasy VI method of, you know, random encounters, side view battles, your turn, my turn, sort of gameplay. With Rings like 3 and 4, we pitted enemies on the map, but it was still kind of that style. Well, with this one, we are definitely going with the Chrono Trigger enemies on the map thing. We want positioning to matter, and you know, we're going to try some other really, really interesting elements, but we're excited to finally have it, battles take place on the maps to kind of do away with random encounters. Some fans, you know, they want random encounters, but we want to do it this way because we think it's fun and exciting, and we're going to try and do some interesting things with battles and ways you can get around enemies too. So we might incorporate certain stuff, maybe, and this is all tentative because we haven't, you know, programmed it in yet, but maybe some cool ways of getting around enemies too, since there's this sort of spy espionage element. I guess the last and cool thing I want to mention is that we also want to do like a Sega CD style like presentation. We want this to be our biggest game that we've ever done. We've made improvements, we've got more efficient, but with this one we want to spend all that extra time building on that experience and creating the biggest game, the most detailed game we've ever done, and get these really cool Sega CD style cutscenes, kind of like our teaser. And we want to create a story that's deeper, still have some humorous elements, but have like a much deeper plot with more interesting characters and stuff going on too. So I guess those 3/4 things are why I'm excited about this project.
The Cosmic Star Heroine Kickstarter is live right now, and it's already looking beautiful. You can find more information about Zeboid Games at zeboid.com. That's Zeboid, Zeboyd.com. You can also follow them on Twitter, at Zeboid Games.
Flash! Flash, I love you! But we only have 14 hours to save the Earth!
Well, our podcast today was produced by myself, Charlie Burton, with contributions by Mick Mulligan and Kevin Chai. Music in this podcast included a track from OC Remix's Final Fantasy VI Tribute album, Balance and Ruin, which you can download right now for free at ocremix.org. Additional music came from the FDL soundtrack by Ben Pudi, which is available on Bandcamp, and from the Chronotorious album, a fully licensed album of Chrono Trigger arrangements, brought to you by the Bad Dudes. The Fangamer podcast is, of course, brought to you by Fangamer, where we have a new line of gym shirts. Pewter, Cerulean, and Vermilion gyms are all represented in either t-shirt form or, for the first time ever, tank tops. Check it out at fangamer.net. you have any questions about the podcast or you'd like to apply to be a contributor, email me, charlie@fangamer.com, and I'll get back to you whenever I can. You can also call and leave us a voicemail at 1-503-446-CAST. That's 1-503-446-2278. Thanks again for listening to the Fangamer Podcast.
That's it for now. See you later. See you later. See you later.